From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for the 20th day of January 2021. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Ben Brown from the University of Missouri. Jackie Vakes is out of the office for the day. And we'll take a look at the weather forecast with Drew Lerner. He's at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
March corn 4 lower today, settled at 522, December at 449, down 6. March soybeans at 16 and a quarter lower, settled $13.69 and a half. November down 17 cents at $11.71 and three quarters. Bean meal futures were off $8.10 and the bean oil up 84 cents. Wheat futures were down 4.5 cents on the afternoon. Live cattle futures finished mostly lower for the day, and the lean hogs were a bit higher. Ben Brown now joins us from the University of Missouri, where he is in FAPRI, the Food and Agricultural Policy Research Institute. And I think, Ben, are you part of Extension there as well?
Yes, sir. Yep. Partly MU Extension and partly with FAPRI MU in the Department of Ag Econ.
Well, since you're in all of those things, what I really want you to do is take another look back for me to the USDA reports released January the 12th. There were four of them, and those generally will set the tone for about 3 months in the trade until we get to the March acreage figures and the grain stocks numbers at the end of the month. Can you go through some of the numbers and kind of give me the foundation that we're working from now?
Yes, and sure. January is always a big month. It's always a really exciting month for geeks like me that like digging through the numbers, because we get so much analysis in January. We get what's supposed to be the final yield estimates for the previous year's crop. The reason I say final is sometimes when we get into the final stock numbers, USDA does have the right to go back and tweak those production numbers just a little bit based on the implied usage and how much we still have on hand. So, but they do a pretty good job that when we get to January, usually those are pretty close to the final numbers. And we get a whole bunch of data from those stocks reports. In this case, it would be the first quarter ending stocks, or what we had on hand as of December 1st. And that always sets the tone for implied use for the rest of the year, just because we use so much of our crop, when of all crops, right after they're harvested. And that makes sense, right? And so January always is a fun and it's a big month. I personally like stocks reports a lot. I think they do frustrate people when we look at corn stocks sometimes in terms of the market shocks that we see, and certainly this year was no different. But I think, stocks reports, and when you step back and look at them with an open mind and you think about why certain things are happening the way they do, and you try to put a story around them, they're really interesting and they kind of play out. And so I'm going to start with the big eye-popping number that the trade really focused on, caught everybody off guard, especially the trade, and we saw the market reactions on corn, was the reduction of 3.8 bushels per acre from the national yield. And that, again, is they don't do a production number in December. So that's a change from the November production report. So from November to here in January, we saw 3.8 bushel reduction in the national yield. Now that is large. I went back and over at least the last three decades, so 30 years, we have not had that big a reduction in the final yield. A couple of things that I'd like to point out, and I know there was a lot of press around this in terms of how did USDA miss the yield that much. What it ended up coming down to was ear weight. The ear weights were a lot lighter coming out of the field than what many people were expecting. And that's what drove that yield component. But I just want to point out that USDA reports surveys and objective yields, and it's weighted based accordingly, but we all missed it. When you take the window surveys or the crop progress surveys that we see during the growing season, and you calculate those out and you apply what we had at the end of the growing season for those progress reports, and you put that into an analysis like that, those were even signaling a much stronger yield than what was coming out. So when I say that USDA missed it, we all missed it. There was just something in that crop that caught us off guard. And in this case, it turned out to be the ear weights, which was the issue. So a pretty large shock there when you look at that drop in yield accompanied with you know, the stocks report in general, we had a very bullish day on corn prices. A couple of things I want to point out. Not only did the drop in supply from the 2020 crop catch people off guard, but there was a 629 million bushel decrease from what the trade expected in the stocks number, in the corn stocks number as of December 1st. Now, I just told you about the yield drop. And so the trade was expecting a yield drop, but not that big of a yield drop. And so when you subtract out what they expected from what actually happened, there was a 28 million bushel surprise or bullish surprise, meaning that the actual drop was 28 million bushels more than what the trade was expecting. So that was what caused that bullish surprise on the production. But when you subtract that 288 million bushels from the 629 million bushels of total stocks, that tells us that not only did we see a production shortfall, but usage was 341 million bushels more than what the trade was expecting. So I guess what I'm telling you, Todd, is that all eyes were on that production number, but I'm sitting here and saying we had a bigger surprise and shock on the usage number. And when we look at that and put that against historical years, there's only been about three times in the last, again, three or four decades, that we've had that big of a usage surprise to the bullish side during the December 1st stocks report. So a big day when we think about that. One of the things and the reason I just went through all that is because we had that big of a usage surprise, mostly feed and residual comes out of that, or that's where a lot of that surprise usually comes from. But USDA went ahead and dropped feed and residual use for the marketing year by 50 million bushels. So I'm kind of scratching my head a little bit of, you know, why did we see such a large surprise above what everybody thought in terms of feed and residual use? And we still saw a reduction in the overall annual feed and residual use. And USDA explains that, you know, with the higher prices, again, tighter supply, higher demand, that's raised prices. We've certainly seen that the last couple of weeks. And then we'll start rationing demand from feed use, but some of the other categories too, like ethanol and exports. We'll start rationing that with higher prices to create our new center point. But I still look at that and scratch my head, and I'm curious as to what, you know, why we saw a reduction when we saw such a bullish surprise in what would ultimately be feed and residual use. So that was on the corn side. I spent a lot of time talking about the corn side. Let me talk about soybeans real quick, and there's really just one area on the soybean side that I want to touch on, because I feel like, you know, the export numbers make sense, and certainly we can talk about that too. But they increased soybean crush 5 million bushels. And I think the last time I talked with you, Todd, the last time we did this, we talked about the strong soybean crush numbers and my expectations for soybean crush to continue through December. And when we look at what the December soybean crush numbers were, they came in at 183.2 million bushels. Now, that's just the National Oilseed Processors Association numbers, and they represent about 95% of the soybeans crushed. But while that was below trade expectations by about 2 million bushels, that's 8.5 million bushels more than what we saw a year ago. And this now makes it the second largest month for soybean crush we've ever had, behind October of this year. So we continue to set impressive soybean numbers, even with increasing soybean price. We continue to set impressive numbers on soybean crush. You calculate everything out, and we're on pace for, you know, a year of about 40 million bushels more than what we did last year in soybean crush. And USDA is currently up 35 from where we started at the beginning of the year, year over year. So right in line with that. And I look for soybean crush to continue even with these higher prices. Now on the export side, we've been looking at export shipments. And again, there's a difference between export sales and what actually gets on the boat and gets shipped. On the soybeans and grain sorghum side, we're doing well. Export sales are maintaining the pace, export shipments are maintaining the pace for grain sorghum and soybeans. Corn shipments continue to fall, and they're currently, at least based on the most current week, short by about 81 million bushels. So that reduction that we saw from USDA on the corn export numbers, it might not be enough, and we might see a little bit more of a reduction. I like to remind folks that we're starting to get to the point where we export a lot of corn. If I mean, we're at the beginning pages of when we typically export a lot of corn. So not only do we need to catch back up to where we should be, but we need to exceed it a little bit because this is normally our heavy export window for corn. On the soybean side, if you calculate everything out, the math would suggest that USDA is 365 million bushels below on soybean exports. Now, that number will not increase that much because we don't have that many soybeans. What this does signal is that we could see even higher soybean prices potentially as a result of this competition for soybean products domestically with soybean crush and internationally for soybeans. We continue to keep all eyes on South America. Argentina is currently in they've got a worker strike, a truck driver strike that's impacting their ability to move product through the country and get it to ports. We look at Brazil. USDA did not change soybean production in Brazil in the January report. I still think it's a little bit early. I expect the revision get one to come in February because just the timing of the Brazilian crop is late. And so I expect that January was just too early to make that revision, but still a record crop in South America right now. The question becomes, will the United States have enough soybeans to meet our domestic needs when Brazil starts supplying the world? And that's a question I think is left to be answered at the moment is, will we actually did we oversell like what Brazil did last year and need to buy some soybeans to get us through our domestic supply? And of course, prices help dictate that in terms of where the commodity goes based on who's willing to be the highest bidder and where the need is the biggest. So, I look ahead. You didn't ask me this question, Todd, but I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to address maybe what I've been thinking about in the last week. When I look ahead to this market as we start the marketing year, start the planting season here in the next couple of months, one of the things that I think is real interesting is instead of soybeans now just dominating the picture and sending the clear signal to producers to plant soybeans, now all of a sudden we've got a corn picture that's going to be very aggressive, and corn is going to compete strongly for acres. On the other side of the coin, you've got sorghum, grain sorghum. China's been buying a lot of grain sorghum. That's really propped up the grain sorghum prices in some of our western states, Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, and they're going to be competing for acres. And so we've got a scenario that we haven't seen in a while to where whichever commodity loses out of this acreage battle, and losing out's the word I do want to use because they all need acres to meet the demand for their products. And I start looking at this and I say, okay, if I'm putting on a farmer hat right now, if I get a window to plant in this early spring period, I'm going to plant as much corn as I can. Corn is profitable, just like soybeans at these prices right now. Same thing with grain sorghum. I expect grain sorghum to take some soybean acres. We usually think of grain sorghum competing with corn, but now we're starting to look at possibilities of grain sorghum taking acres from soybeans in the Western Corn Belt, Kansas, Oklahoma area as well. And we could end up in a possibility to where there's just not enough acres in the soybean picture to meet the demand. And we continue to see, a crazy volatile, sporadic pricing signal on the soybean side as well. So I look at January. January did nothing to dampen the fears of, or the January WASDE report did nothing to dampen the fears of, just overpricing something. In fact, it gave some more wind behind the sales. What we've seen in the last day or two here lately is people with historically long positions, speculators, merchandisers with historically long positions, selling out of those positions and profit taking at these marks. And so we've dropped down and filled the corn gap that was experienced earlier this month when that WASDE report came out. We've seen a decrease in soybeans. They were down big overnight last night and down to start the day. And so a little bit of a retraction, but I do expect it to find its footing a little bit and recover just because we've got some very strong fundamentals now that we haven't seen in several years.
Hey, thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd.
That's Ben Brown. He's with University of Missouri. On this Wednesday afternoon, Drew Lerner joins us from World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Good afternoon to you, Drew. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, sir, and happy inaugural day.
Well, happy inaugural day to you as well. Let's start not here in the United States, but in South America. We'll work our way northward from Argentina through Brazil and into the U.S. Begin, though, with Argentina. Really dry conditions there for a long time. Have they turned the corner at all?
It does look like they have. The last 10 days to 2 weeks have really generated some decent rainfall. Now, their deep subsoil moisture is still lacking. There are still some dry pockets even at the surface, but they are nowhere near as numerous as they were a couple of weeks ago. And it does appear that the pattern will be favoring more periodicity in the rainfall as we go into February. And so the odds of us getting back to the same level of dryness that we were in earlier this month and in December is relatively low. Not impossible, and I don't want us to just totally turn our backs on Argentina and assume that that's it for this game. I don't think that's necessarily the case, but I do think it's going to be a little less intensive there, the dryness that is, and we will see crops develop a little better than they have. The rains that did occur over the past 2 weeks have been just really nice. Topsoil moisture is rated favorably in much of the country today. They are going to be very warm and dry for the next 4 days, though, and that'll firm it up again. Some rain and thunderstorms are expected to evolve later this weekend and into next week. That will offer some sporadic relief. Not everybody's going to get rain, and looks like the drier biased areas will be in the south. So that'll be the area that we'll watch as we go into February.
As you work your way northward, Uruguay, Paraguay, some of the southern states of Brazil, are they faring a little better too?
Yeah, you know, for a La Nina year, southern Brazil has done really very well. There's been some dryness, no doubt, and early season corn took a hit in Rio Grande do Sul and some neighboring areas there, even Paraguay for that matter, and Paraná. But the soybean crop has recovered nicely from the rough start, not only in those areas, but through a large part of Brazil. And soil moisture, as of yesterday in Brazil, was the best it's been all season. Topsoil conditions were rated adequate to surplus, and subsoil moisture adequate with a couple of pockets of slightly short moisture is really a very good environment. And it comes pretty darn late. We're going to be harvesting here in a few weeks, and some harvest is already underway, but the bulk of it will probably come in early to mid-February. And so there might be a little interest in the rainfall frequency in Brazil as we move through this next few week period because of that potential issue that it rains too much. But, you know, the Brazilians, they have always harvested in a showery weather pattern, and they do very well in that environment. So I would be real careful at it's even suggesting that there would be delays there. It would have to rain day and night, literally. And be fairly frequent in order to really cause them great grief.
In the center west, Mato Grosso, Rodinha, how are things progressing? And as you look forward, what does the Safrinha or second corn crop set up like?
Yeah, you know, those center west crop areas still are getting lighter than usual rainfall, but normal for them is so much more than what is needed that this environment now is certainly not a bad one at all. Everybody will get rain routinely now over these next 2 weeks, maybe three. And I think that the moisture profile is still going to be a little off down deep in the ground. But I think from a surface moisture perspective and for developing and supporting the soybean crop, it's not a bad scenario. For Safrinha crops, of course, that lack of moisture deep in the ground might be of greater interest when we get close to the end of the rainy season in Mato Grosso. Most of those crops there, as you know, are real dependent upon having a full moisture profile down deep into the ground as we go into April and May in order to support the reproductive process for Safrinha corn and cotton. And if they come into that season and they don't have a lot of good deep subsoil moisture, there's a pretty good chance that when the rainy season ends, will dry out the topsoil, and some of that moisture will percolate down into the ground and make it difficult to reach for crops to reach. So it might be kind of an interesting issue. So if they get abundant rain over these next few weeks, it may slow the harvest, but it might help that second season crop quite a bit down the road.
Here in the United States, a large part of the western U.S. is in some form of drought, some of it really, really long-lasting and deep. Do you have concerns about this?
I do. Latest North American drought monitor does show notable drought from eastern parts of Canada's prairies through most of the western plains and all of the western United States except the Pacific Northwest, and also down into northern and central Mexico. So it's a huge amount of real estate that has varying degrees of drought. And with La Nina still hanging in there and probably sticking with us through the end of the winter, there's a fairly good chance we're not going to be able to recover. It may rain better, it may snow a little better, but I don't think we're going to be able to get that moisture profile back to where it needs to be, especially not in the southern part of the United States. I will say the southern half of the Great Basin, southern Rocky Mountains, southwest plains, and northern Mexico. Those areas are going to keep their moisture deficits. For Canada, Canada's eastern prairies will probably keep their deficits, as will the northwest plains, at least into March. And then they will have an opportunity for relief as we go into April and May. For the areas east of this drought region, I think the Midwest will have a relatively good start to the spring season. I think there may be a potential for the eastern Midwest and the southeastern states to have a little drier bias, so some aggressive planting will occur there, and maybe a little chatter about worry over the dryness there sometime in May or so. The Western Corn Belt will be in the best shape, but it's not going to have their deep and darkest, I shouldn't say darkest, but their deepest subsoil moisture is probably not going to be fully recharged, which kind of sets the stage for perhaps some interesting conditions in the summer.
What kinds of things?
I knew you were going to ask me that. Well, that's a subject matter that probably don't have enough time to cover here, but I do think that with the drought expected to linger in the western United States, the negative phase of Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which is a whole nother discussion, but that is probably going to be with us this summer. Lingering La Nina, even if La Nina dissipates, there's still going to be a flavor of La Nina around. And the position that we're in right now with the solar cycle, all of these things come together and kind of make it hard to get good rainfall to take place. And if conditions come together just right, I think we may have some moisture shortage issues to discuss as we get into the heart of summer. But that's all a little ways too far out in time. But we're going to be watching all of that very closely.
Hey, thank you so much, and thanks for keeping an eye on it.
All right. Have a great day.
Hey, you too. That's Drew Lerner. He is with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City and helped us wrap up this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media.